2:30 docket at this time. We have one case on that docket, and the case is in the interest of BBO and Barry, the appellant, respondent appellant. Counsel, you may set up, and when you're ready to proceed, you may do so. I should advise you that we have read the briefs in the case. We have, we're familiar with the record. If that helps streamline your presentation, so be it. And once again, I'll ask people in the audience to please turn off cell phones and pagers so that we're not disturbed during the argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Randy Goodman, appearing pro hoc vice from Oklahoma, Oklahoma Bar Association number 11091. I'm here today to ask the court to restore custody of a minor child to the natural mother. Initially, in this case, there was no allegation of unfitness on the part of the mother. There was two concerns voiced by the petitioner stated in the record in the deposition. That was that the mother would leave with the child and never come back to Colorado to allow the petitioner half-sister to see her again. And the other was that the mother was only interested in the money, the Social Security benefit that the petitioner is receiving in the amount of approximately $1,600 a month. In the case in Ray Troxel, the Supreme Court has ruled that there's a special relationship that exists between a mother and a child. They said there's a higher protection due to the, protect this interest. There's a fundamental liberty interest in this. And that outside a showing of unfitness, that this relationship should not be disturbed to a non-parent. I would submit to the court that when this paternity action was initially filed by the deceased father in the fall of 2007, there was no allegation of unfitness. As a matter of fact, the paternity order that was issued after the death of the father specifically said that the mother shall have reasonable visitation as agreed upon between the parties. I would like to point out to the court that the paternity order was submitted to the court for signing and for filing after the death of the father, the very same day. It was the testimony in the case from the half-sister of the petitioner that they immediately called the attorney after the father died and asked where that order was granting rights to the deceased father. So the order that was filed the day after the, or the day of the death of the father, and an amended order 30 days later, essentially granted custody to a deceased man. But both of those orders made no finding of unfitness on the part of the mother. The evidence is, and the testimony is right otherwise. Nancy Alatalde was a licensed psychologist engaged. She found the mother to be a fit, loving, caring, nurturing person with no psychological barriers to her operation as a fit parent. The CFI said the same thing. She said her observations when she observed the parent and the child together was one of loving, fun, and affection. She noted that the relationship did not exist when she saw the exchange between the minor child and the petitioner half-sister. There was evidence and testimony from, the mother has a daycare, licensed in the state of Oklahoma. There was evidence and testimony from parents that provided their child to the care of the mother. The daycare itself. The court ruled on a date certain as the date of filing petition for paternity by the petitioner, the half-sister, that on that date, that the mother was unfit. And frankly, there's no evidence in the record at all to support that finding. He said that while she's demonstrated an ability to be a fit parent since that time, that he would find on that specific day that she was unfit. We have raised essentially from the very beginning the issue of standing. I think in the case, CRC is instructive on this case that says that a parent must consent to a non-parent, and that consent cannot be imputed by one parent to the other. The court found that by, on the basis of the petitioner half-sister living in the home with the father, who's now deceased, that granted her some type of special standing because she resided in the home. If that argument is true, then the same would be true of a step-parent, stepfather, stepmother, or a nanny, which the record reflects that the petitioner said that she considered herself as more of a nanny. Or any person that resides in the household, whether the father was ill or not. The death of the father was hid from the mother. It was not until 20 days after the death that she was able to find out by calling his work. Despite her frequent calls, she was to visit the minor child during spring break of 2008.
Mr. Goodman, isn't standing, putting aside for the moment the failure to inform about the death of the father, isn't standing under CRC also established so long as the burden is met in proving that the natural parent voluntarily permitted the non-parent to share in or assume parent's responsibility of physical care of the child?
I believe the court, that case says specifically, Your Honor, that consent must be given and that it can't be imputed to the non-custodian. So the very fact that the mother allowed the child to stay there does not mean that she consented to the half-sister to provide care and custody of this minor child. There's nothing in the record that would show that. Outside, I believe there was a thank you note issued, but I mean, you can issue a thank you note to an aunt, an uncle, a half-sister, like I said, anyone residing in the house, though. So I think that CRC is very clear on this case, and I don't think that...
What do we do about the fact that in this case, the mother went for a period of 4 years with knowledge that the half-sister was caring for the child? Although you perhaps can't impute consent to the other parent.
Your Honor, if I may?
Well, if I could finish my question.
I'm sorry.
If you can't impute consent to the other parent, why can't we why can't we conclude in this case that the record supports the court's finding that the sister or the parent acquiesced?
Because, Your Honor, all the communication was between the father and the mother. When the paternity action was filed in the fall of 2007, he called the mother, and the testimony and the record will reflect this, saying he needed it for insurance purposes. Never in that temporary order is the half-sister mentioned as a person that has any custodial care or any rights to this child. Neither in either of the paternity orders that were submitted. There is another important factor in that consideration, Your Honor, and that is the battered wife syndrome. The trial court judge found that while the mother didn't live in an abusive relationship, there was no evidence to support that she was a battered wife. That's contrary to the record. It's contrary to there's one person qualified as an expert in the area of the battered wife syndrome, and that was Beverly Compton Amos. And not only was she qualified, she actually treated and counseled both parties when they were alive and when they were married. She saw the blackened eyes. She saw the bruises. The battered wife syndrome is a phenomenon that is often beyond explanation. Why would someone stay in that? The only person that was qualified as an expert witness said this can go on for years. You know, the battered wife can say, oh, maybe I did scramble the eggs too long. Maybe I should have dusted in the corners. And they are succumbing to this authority figure for a long time, even after the relationship is over. And that is the case here. The court said that on the record that while its memory may not be as good as it once was, the record still reflects that the battered wife syndrome, which she found did not exist, was unrefuted by the only person so qualified to testify in that area. Also, in the case of Henry Crossland, and there's been no show of that this mother is a detriment to the minor child. And as fact, the evidence is the other side. Even from the very witnesses that the petitioner put on, the sister and the aunt, they knew of no detriment to the minor child by moving to Oklahoma to be with the natural mother. This wasn't a relationship also, Judge, if I may expound on that point of the question that you asked a little bit. This wasn't a point of an estranged, complete stranger relationship between the child and the parent. The mother raised this child for the first 3 years. I would ask the court to look at Exhibit 11, the note that was written by this 8-year-old girl 2 weeks to 2-3 weeks after her father died. It says, "Dear Mom, I've learned a new cursive, and guess what? I'm good at it. Love you, love you." The name of my child, hearts all over. She hadn't seen her for 3 or 4 years. They've exchanged gifts and cards. The battered wife syndrome, Judge, if I may digress into that a little bit, too, the testimony was of the mother that he had threatened her. When she became pregnant with her child that's 4, she would be 5 in October, she was told that he, that by the deceased, that she did not, he did not want his, this minor child to know she had a younger sister and to not come to Colorado, or she would never see her daughter again. She believed him. The best interest standard, specifically 1410.124.4, says that if abuse is a factor, that it shall not be considered by the court for the absence of one of the parents. It was present in this, and it was even recognized by the court. While the court didn't recognize the battered wife syndrome, he certainly recognized the abuse. Another factor of 10, or the best interest standard, is the ability to nurture a relationship between the parent, or between the child and the other party. The court hung its hat on the fact that the mother showed not any regard for the child, but she wanted the child after learning about the death of the father. She called. She wanted to come to Colorado. She made a hotel reservation, a car reservation. She was told not to come. She couldn't see the daughter. Then she was told she could come the next week. Once again, hotel reservations. Drove all the way to Denver from Oklahoma City. Halfway here was told, in the record, this is in the record, got a phone call that you can't see your child unless you sign a document, which to this day has not been presented, and come to the home alone. The petitioner was asked to bring the child to the hotel they were staying at so she could give her some gifts and see her. They refused. Instead, they carried out their threats by trying to have a protection order filed against the mother, so the next time she came to Colorado, they would have her arrested. The record is also supportive of the inability of the petitioner to nurture a relationship between the mother and the child. She placed an alarm in the backpack of this 7 or 8 year old girl and sent her to school. And the principal even testified that when the alarm went off, the little girl cried. So that's the kind of relationship that she was nurturing, not one of transition. Beryl Coppenang said that she believed that the child should be with a mother eventually. By the end of that school year, in any event, no later than 2 years. The trial court said, no, we're going to leave it with a half-sister, and that's where it will stay. On the issue of attorney fees, one of the criteria is that you make an analysis of the different financial conditions of the party. As of December of 2008, the petitioner had invested approximately $84,000 through different litigation. This action she filed for guardianship, that was denied. She filed to have herself appointed as the replaced or substituted for the father in the paternity action. That was denied. The mother's had pro bono help and has made all these trips through loans or gifts. The court should have weighed the financial factors between the two parties and allocated. I think there was testimony in the record says that the petitioner had a $65,000 CD and another $350,000 in trust assets. Those should be allocated in some portion to provide a level playing field. It's a slippery slope that we are on when we deprive a parent, a fit parent, the rights to raise and rear their child. Whether it's to a half-sister, an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, or a nanny, or a step-parent, or the gardener that happens to live in the household, I would request this court to restore this minor child to the custody of her mother and to award appropriate attorney fees in accordance with the financial conditions of the parties as reflected in the record. Thank you.
Mr. Goodman, you have about 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Please report. My name is Rebecca Warfield Brown. My attorney registration number is 34905. And together with Ms. John Slaughter Pellegrin, who is seated at the table, registration number 12013, would represent petitioner Regina Olds in this action. This is not a case about parental rights. This is a case about parenting. I say this is not a case about parental rights because Ms. Berry's rights are completely intact. And in fact, the court's order affords her greater parenting time and greater decision-making authority than she cared to exercise for a period of years prior to petitioner's sister filing this action. Ms. Berry continues to assert a number of facts that she would like this court to review. The trial court's finding of fact is entitled to deference by this court, absent a finding by this court that those findings of facts were without record support and clearly erroneous. That is not the case here. The trial court's findings are supported by the record.
Where is the record support to show that the mother was unfit?
Your Honor, the trial court relied on two things in finding that mother was unfit. And I think we need to remember how Troxell v. Granville defines fitness when we think about what the trial court did in this case. And the Troxell v. Granville defines fitness as providing adequate care. In deciding that mother was not fit at the time this action was filed, the trial court relied primarily on the fact that she was absent from this child's life for a period of at least 4 years. This child last saw her mother when she was 4 years old. She turned 5 without seeing her mother. She turned 6 without seeing her mother. She turned 7 without seeing her mother. She turned 8 without seeing her mother. These are huge factors to consider when considering fitness, because fitness is defined as providing adequate care. Similarly, I apologize, Your Honor, I'm flustered. Similarly, the trial court looked at the involvement in the child's life, and besides just the void, the trial court found that it was suspect and lacking. That supports the trial court's finding that mother was unfit. If you're not providing adequate care, according to Troxell, you are not entitled to the deference. But more importantly, the trial court still deferred to mother's constitutional right regardless, because what the trial court stated was that in this particular case, we had to not just consider Troxell, he considered the then recent law, which was Abrams, well, it wasn't recent, I'm sorry. He didn't have the benefit of Reese. I think that's the white elephant that's in the room for all of us, is the fact that this court did not have the benefit of some clearer outlining that was done by a different division of this court in Re Parental Responsibilities of Reese. So the trial court looks at what it's dealing with, which is a non-parent versus a biological parent. And the court absolutely recognizes that these two animals do not stand on the same footing as far as the Constitution, and cites to Abrams v. Connolly, which discusses that in Colorado we recognize a biological parent has a presumption that they make to the custody of the child. I apologize.
And a fundamental right to make decisions regarding the care, custody, and control of the child.
Absolutely. The court then says, well, we do have under Abrams v. Connolly and subsequent case law in Colorado, including Root v. Allen and In Re CCRS, to name two, is that we then can look at the best interest of the child, because Colorado is the best interest of the child state, and that controls. So I need to find something that outweighs mother's right to make the determination.
Well, it's not just outweighing it, isn't it? I mean, on the best interest, the standard is clear and convincing evidence. And I don't see those words anywhere in the trial court's orders. So what do we do about that? It's not clear to me that the judge applied the right legal burden here.
Your Honor, I would argue two things. The first is, as I just mentioned, the court definitely didn't have the benefit of the Reese decision because it hadn't happened yet.
But we do.
But you do, absolutely. And I will get to that if you'll give me one moment. I would also posit that at this point in time, our Supreme Court hasn't spoken to the facts of clear and convincing evidence with regard to 1410.123. It very much has spoken regarding 19.1117, which is grandparenting rights. And it's also spoken soon after the Troxell decision with regard to dependency and neglect cases where a parent was awarded rights. A parent's rights were largely transferred to a guardian, but the parental rights were left intact, and that's In Re, the interest of RW. And what the court said in September of 2000 with regard to that situation, which is also not exactly on point here, but since we're talking about apples and oranges regardless, I think it's important to remember, is that when parental rights were left intact, not terminated, they were troubled by the fact that it wasn't clear and convincing evidence. Similarly, with regard to the 19.1117 case, I think we need to remember that one, much like Troxell v. Granville, dealt with a parent who had a day-to-day relationship with the children or child in the CA, one child in the CA, that said, you know what, we need to worry about respect to those rights because those people know what this child needs. They're providing adequate care. The situation is entirely different under 1410.123, because when you get to 1410.123, particularly when you're in the area of B or C, you're dealing with a void. And in fact, in the interest of CTG, another division of this court has said, without the void, you're not going to get a 1410.123.1c case. You need a parental void in order to have a psychological parent step in and fill that role. That's what the court found here. But I'm sorry to take so long to get there, but to get back to your actual question, which is clear and convincing evidence, I think we need to deconstruct the court's ruling in light of the fact that it didn't have the privilege of having Reese. So what the court says is I'm dealing with two people who are not on the same footing. If I were in a case where it was two biological parents, this would not be a hard decision. The only thing that you can read that to say is, since we know what he decided, is that he would have found for sister easily if he were entitled to put them on the same footing. The court then recognizes that he's not. And what he says is, I have to defer. If you go with 1325.127, which is the burden of proof in a typical case, thus the burden of proof with regard to a biological parent versus a biological parent, that's the preponderance of the evidence. In this case, the court said, I need something more. Because what he said was, I'm troubled. I'm troubled in this case because I must defer to the biological parent's right to make care and custody decisions. The court then outlined the special factors that it considered when deciding that this child's best interest lay with the petitioner's sister, and the special factors that it primarily considered, it did recognize and considered 1410.124 factors in general, but that in light of the presumption in favor of the mother, it then said the suspect and lacking nature of the relationship as between mother and child, the void in the life, the fact that this court did not find that there was any effort to keep her away from her child. In fact, the court found that father was open and willing to have a visit. So the court makes the special factors findings required by Troxell. It recognizes that it is not working in a typical case, i.e. preponderance of the evidence, and then finds that BDO's best interest lay with petitioner's sister. I put forth to you that that is an implied finding of clear and convincing evidence, because what else could it be? If it's not preponderance, the next higher standard is clear and convincing, and that the court very, very much deferred to this biological parent's right when it made its decision. It cited it not once, but twice. And in fact, not once, but twice said, if this were not a non-parent versus a parent, it wouldn't be troubled. He would have made a decision. She would have gone home with her sister, and we'd be done. But it stopped, and it thought hard. It didn't have the benefit of Reese. It did, however, have the benefit of years of decisions regarding the fact that we actually do need to think about the biological parent's rights. And then it found special factors that outweighed the parent's interest in this case. And I would put forth that's an implied finding of clear and convincing evidence, and that an implied finding under In Re Marriage of Farr is actually acceptable to this court. This court can say that the court's decision, when read all together, supports an implied finding of a necessary finding that the court must make. That said, I'm sorry, did I address the question sufficiently, Your Honor?
It was a long answer, but I think you got there.
I apologize. It's a long way to get there. With regard to consent, opposing counsel, with all due respect, has put forth that there must be an explicit finding of consent under In Re CRC, and I would put forth that that is not what actually In Re CRC says. What happened in In Re CRC is division of this court said that that court's finding of implicit consent was not actually supported by the record, and that is different in this case. This court made a finding that mother was aware of where this child was and who was providing care for this child, and it is supported by record evidence. Mother herself testified she was aware that sister petitioner was in the home. Mother herself, as recognized by counsel, there was a thank you card thanking her for everything she had done for BBO. Mother testified that her relationship with the child was primarily done through packages. The evidence she presented, which is respondents Exhibit number 3, was actually a number of receipts sent by her elder daughter. And that's fine. Her elder daughter worked with her to send the packages. But then I think you need to look to Respondents 40, which shows that sister and mother looking to my client, petitioner for sister, to find out what BBO's likes were. What kind of things does she want? They knew this person was intimately related and working with this child, so much so that they asked parental type questions to her. They asked her, what kind of things does she like for the gift? They asked her, could we get, and again, it's Respondents 40, could we get a picture? That was mother. I'm sorry.
Slow down.
I'm trying, Your Honor. I do apologize.
Brown, CRC says as follows, that under 1410.123, a non-parent, in order to establish standing, has a burden of proof that the natural parent voluntarily permitted the non-parent to share in or assume the parent's responsibility. In this case, how can you make that finding when everything the mother did was based upon the knowledge and the assumption that the father was alive.
I would point to two important factors with regards to that. The first is mother herself testified that father was drunk and depressed sometimes. And quite frankly, she's aware that sister's in the home. She's sending thank you cards recognizing what sister's doing. And she's telling the trial court that she knew that from time to time father was drunk and depressed in a way that makes you wonder, who's caring for this child? I think
there's nothing in the record to indicate that she is voluntarily acquiescing in the sister parenting the child. Her assumption is, and I think the record is quite clear, is that the father is living. That might explain why the half-sister refused to tell her the truth about the death of the father.
Your Honor, I would like to point this court to the trial court's finding that they were not indeed hiding father's death from mother. That's at CD Volume 3, page 229, where the court recognizes that while the call was not made immediately, and I can't change the facts, they weren't hiding it. If they were choosing to hide it, they could have continued to not answer the phone. They could have continued to
die. I didn't suggest they were hiding it. I simply suggested that they didn't tell her the truth.
I don't think they told her anything for a brief period of time, Your Honor, because they...
Well, let's not split hairs.
And I would put forth that grieving people don't always make their best decisions right away. And there is evidence that after 20 days, according to opposing counsel, and I believe that is correct, they did make sure mom knew. They did make sure that mom was able to speak to BBO. They took the call. They got the child available.
And she immediately, upon learning of the father's death, sought custody of the child.
Actually, Your Honor, I would pose that's not entirely true because my client brought this action. There was a period of time which mother did.
I thought she made a demand.
She testified to that for certain. Okay. But in terms of actually taking legal action, and I think in terms, I've got 2 minutes, so I want to do quickly to distinguish CRC in ways that I think are absolutely important. That mother immediately took action as soon as she knew that her child was not where she left her child. She had a continual relationship with her child. She left for a finite period of time. This mother left for a period of years. No one's really sure when she ever planned to come back. Now, she testifies as to her reasons why.
Oh, it's pretty clear. She waited. The record suggests pretty strongly that she was afraid of this man. He'd beaten her, and she was afraid of him. So once he was out of the picture, she was willing to come back into the picture. And if we affirm this, do we send a message to abusive fathers that if they just simply threaten enough, they can deprive the mother of their child?
Your Honor, with due respect, absolutely not. I think it's extremely important that this trial court consider the abuse and then considered that it was enough attenuated that mother had actually, for a period of, it's not entirely clear, but it sounds like about a year, actually did visit the child. She did work and she had an amicable relationship with Mr. Olds. And Mr. Olds is not a party to this case. There's a break where she interacts with her child. And for as much as she testifies about abuse, we need to also remember that in 2002, she not only asked Mr. Olds to take her child with him, she asked him to take another child whose father was very much alive. The court didn't believe her when it came to the abuse rising to the level that she could not interact with her child. The court specifically found that she was able to interact with her child and that, in fact, Mr. Olds was open at all times to the visits. In fact, the reasoning she gives for why the visit stopped, which was her pregnancy with her youngest child, the pregnancy was a year after the last visit. And that also is in the record. So I would put forth that this is not the case to send that message because the trial court, with credible evidence, found that that was not the case, that there's something, some other reason. He didn't find why, and I don't think he needs to. He found her excuse didn't work. He found she abandoned her child effectively for a period of several years, and that this child's best interest lay with the person who provided her day-to-day care during that time. And again, I've got 12 seconds, but the record demonstrates that this woman did provide that care. She did make sure that this child got medical care. She went to school visits. She was filling a parent role. And the fact that mother didn't know was because mother wasn't around. And I think that is extremely important in determining this matter. Thank you very much, Your Honor, for your time.
Brown. Mr. Goodman?
I think counsel made a telling comment when she said the court said I need to find some way to grant custody of this child to the petition. The evidence is devoid of the fitness, of unfitness on the part of the respondent mother. The clear and convincing standard was not applied here.
you know, they act like this child and mother didn't know each other. I pointed to you the exhibit, which was the note of the minor child. I also request this court to look at the handwritten notes of the St. Vrain Family Center, which is Exhibit 80, that notes this relationship, this reunion between mother and child, how they joined together, how they laughed, how they played, how the daughter did not want to leave, and she kept asking how much time, and she asked to go out and wave goodbye. And she, those notes are telling what this relationship is. Also, we submitted into evidence, which the court may have had a chance to look at, a DVD, which was submitted and admitted into evidence. I would request this court to look at that as far as the relationship. To paint a picture that this there was hardly any relationship between this parent and child, it's not correct. And the court did say, found several things. Whether it reviewed the record very carefully or not, I can't tell, because it appears that it was relying on his own memory when he said that it wasn't as good. He found that this new child in the petitioner's life was the sibling of the minor child. It's the nephew. He found that this minor child was only with the mother for 1.5 years. She raised him for the first 3 years. He found there was no evidence of a battered life center. He didn't mention the clear and convincing standard. This is a case where it looks like a decision was made to carve out a niche, a way to keep this child into Colorado. It says the court thought long and hard about this. I would suggest that it's not a closing process, and that the custody belongs to the mother, as I have previously stated and as my brief enunciates. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Thank you again, Ms. Brown. The court appreciates and understands counsel's passion in this matter. Your arguments were helpful to us today. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in this important case in due course.